From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Our Dean Watt's life has never followed a plan. He's never been much of a goal setter, for example. Life for him, he says, is improvised from moment to moment. So you take what comes and you go with it. It's really how he came to work with the Utah Symphony. The conductor Maurice Bravenel hired him on the spot. It wasn't anything he was looking for necessarily or expecting, and it led to a career there of 22 years. And try going on a hike with Watts, though he doesn't do a whole lot of that these days. He's more interested in the journey than getting there. The same can be said for the experience that made him rethink his faith when he reached middle age. There was no lead up to it at all, he said. It was just wham. That's the quote, wham. Today in the program, we're talking to R. Dean Watts. Join us after the news. This is Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a good chance you may have heard one or two of the stories R. Dean Watts will tell today, because there's a good chance you've had a conversation with the man, whether you knew him or not. A couple of times a week, he used to go down to the City Creek Mall and talk to people, mostly strangers. These days, he tries to chat people up at the Costco. And if you've had an encounter with R. Dean, you may not have learned that he was the associate conductor of the Utah Symphony for a number of years. He was with the symphony for 22 years. Because he prefers to hear your stories rather than tell his own. In the days he was going to the City Creek Mall, they wouldn't let him take a sign, so he had a T-shirt made. It said, "Visit R. Dean Watts." And that's kind of the best way to describe the show today. We're going to visit R. Dean. And there's a lot to talk about, as you many of you may know. He's lived a very full and a very fascinating life. R. Dean Watts, as I said, spent 22 years with the Utah Symphony. He's a pianist, served as an associate conductor from 1968 to 1979 when he retired. He was also musical director, principal conductor for Ballet West. He is a professor emeritus of music at the University of Utah. There's a whole litany of things. Founder of the Mushroom Society of Utah. We'll get to that a little bit later on the program. R. Dean Watts, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
How good to be with you. Finally reached the zenith of my career.
Yeah, right.
Before I died.
So, this is so obvious to go back to, you were born in Kanawha, but not raised there. You were raised in Idaho Falls.
Right.
And I was thinking, one of the things that you've talked about is that there's this sort of general principle of improvisation that seems to have directed you in your life. So you didn't have a plan when you were little, really, necessarily? You didn't have an idea of where it may head your life?
I don't remember aspiring to anything. And that was especially notable to me because I was a very close friend of John Goddard, who was an explorer featured in Time magazine, who had made 120 goals. And that was worth – it was not Time magazine. It was Life magazine. Right. And he would visit with us in Utah every year for several weeks, staying at our home. He was the world's best example, perhaps, of a goal setter, made his career out of it, and it just never did caught on. So we had – with me. So we always had interesting discussions about – which is the better way to find your way through life? And at 87, I'm still trying to figure it out.
Did you ever think, at least in those early days, though, that you had a purpose, that somewhere in the universe, however it worked, you were intended to end up somewhere in some way?
As a Mormon, I bought into the Mormon purpose.
Yeah.
And I probably fulfilled that in spades by having 8 children and 40 grandchildren and all of the stuff that goes with that. And I really had a lot of fun in doing the Mormon thing, which is surrounded with purpose.
Yeah.
That is a goal.
Yeah.
But improvisers don't do that exactly. And I felt much more comfortable trying to deal with the delights that were offered me on a silver platter on a daily basis that were so intriguing that I didn't dare pass any of them up that I had the time and the means to pursue. And I did know at an early age that I was leaned toward music.
Yeah.
I had a young man moved next door to us who was a couple of years older than I, who had never gone to school because he was hemophilic. And he introduced me to classical music, probably the most important person in my professional life.
Wow.
And
wait, what do you mean? Played records for you?
I mean, high school kids would gather in his house where his dad had a Philco, and we would listen to old shellac records.
Yeah.
Which indeed in that house were played by cactus needles. And at the end of each side, we'd take out the needle and sharpen it on a sharpener, like a pencil sharpener, put it back in so that it wouldn't damage – it would limit the damage that was done. And that worked into regular like Saturday Night Live
– sessions.
Sessions. Not only with records, but with the broadcasts of symphonies that could barely be heard from Salt Lake City among the static.
Yeah.
And
but you were picking out beautiful music in that.
Well, they were the national broadcasts of the Boston Symphony.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday afternoon, right after dinner, we would also go over there to hear the NBC Symphony and the New York Philharmonic. And this was all a result of the power of this young guy whose life had been changed because he was totally self-educated. He
had
never been to school.
And confined to his room, basically.
Exactly. And so he created a society of not poets but musicians in the most unlikely place. I mean – Idaho Falls was a cowboy place, and here we were, a sizable troop of people lying on the floor, hands under chins, getting as close to the speakers as we could on a regular basis so that we could hear classical music. And that's how it came to be that we inflected our tastes on other people, and our tastes were crazy because we thought that the modern stuff was what it was all about. And so it was the Rite of Spring of Stravinsky.
Yeah.
That we would almost answer automatically was our favorite tune. And then, would you like to hear it? It's only 28 minutes long.
and there goes the oboe and you're off, right?
Yeah.
So this is interesting. So the Rite of Spring, you have talked about it there being something that you seem to like about it was that there was something subversive about it. There was this hint of rebellion in it. Is that part of what appealed to you?
No. No, I had never thought of rebellion at the time. What excited me about it was that it was new. It was the classical music that he introduced to us.
Yeah.
And it was so full of energy and unpredictability. That is, it just didn't sound like square music.
Yeah.
And for teenagers, that's a good thing.
So at what point did you get to Vienna? At what point did you figure, I'm going to go study music?
Well, my mother started me in piano lessons at age 5. At age 6, the teacher said, save your money. So I was not immediately
no prodigy.
A prodigy.
Yeah.
And so at age 8, my mother was undeterred by this and so started with another teacher. And at 8, I gave my first recital in the ward house. And it was a full evening recital. I have no idea what I played.
Just you?
I know it was bad, but I don't know. I have no memory of it whatsoever. But I had, there was a certain thing that was evoked by performing that I responded to. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was probably a theme that stuck with me. I love performing, but I didn't like practicing.
Right.
That was a
you never really have,
somewhat,
as I understand
it. Well, I didn't understand it until I was 30 years old, and then it suddenly came to me that I needed sociality. And the sociality of practicing the piano for 4 hours a day is nil.
Right.
But working with an orchestra, coaching singers in opera, giving lessons, teaching classes, all of that is highly social. And it provides a place, room for improvisation. I mean, it's endless.
So there's a theme. You need people.
I do need people, and that was – I didn't realize that until I was about 30 years old, and I only saw it in retrospect. I was trying to defend myself, make a good person out of me, because good persons love to practice. And I couldn't quite harmonize those two until I got to be 30 years old.
Wow.
Anyway through high school, I had a lot of blessings that came to me by being able to perform. I could stay out late at night. I ate at hotels. My family never ate out. And I made a little cash on the side. It was really a good thing. So at about age 15, I started a band. Up in Idaho, and we played church stuff and club stuff. And during the war, that led to an all-summer engagement near Yellowstone Park at Max Inn.
Wow.
And that was wild. I mean, living away from home at a very early age, at 16, not too bad. And so my folks, for my birthday when I went up there, gave me a wind-up phonograph because I didn't have any electricity in the cabin up there. And I bought two records. I had two classical records that I took up there and played until they were white.
Yeah. The old shellac ones.
That's right.
They crumble after a while, don't they?
They just get – well, ours never did crumble. They just wore out. I loved the freedom of all of that, and jazz was very interesting to me at the time. So after a stint at BYU that was interesting for other reasons, I had my first girlfriend then.
Yeah.
And that's probably the most striking event of my first year of college. Then I went to L.A. for a year, and I lived with my aunt, and I spent all my time on the Sunset Strip listening to jazz bands.
Wow.
And I heard everybody. And it didn't even enter my head that one day my band would be backing up Matt Cole and Sarah Vaughan and the Four Freshmen and all, I mean, people that were really somebodies, you know, never entered my head.
When was it?
So it was after I was married. My first year, the first year after I was married, that it was obvious to me that I was probably not going to be a great pianist. And I went to Vienna to find out.
To make sure you got that right.
And it took about 10 minutes. That is, I met kids that were 12 years old that could just play circles around me.
Yeah.
And I thought I was good. So I had to look around then for some other way of expressing myself. So I finished my first year after Vienna was here. And that's when I got a job playing piano with a house band at Saltaire, which was a roaring place still, and at the Terrace Ballroom.
Yeah.
Then the band leader got sick, needed to get out of the business, and I bought the band, which means the lights and the stands and the library, and it became Ardeen Watts and his band, and that's how I got into that business. And it was roaring fun.
When did you meet Marisa Bravanel? Like, when was the – not just generally. When did you first encounter Marisa Bravanel?
After I got back here from Vienna. And by that time, we had three children, as I remember. We settled here in Utah, and about 2 years into that, I was playing the national anthem for an event at the U of U, where I was a graduate student, and a man named Bravanel was introduced to me as the one who was going to lead the singing. And that was it. That was the beginning of another life. And I've heard about the nine lives of cats.
Yeah.
And there was somebody who popularized seven lives in a movie once, I think. But I've had many, many, many different lives. But that one came along at the right moment. It was, if I didn't believe in synchronicity, that would have made me a believer. And actually, I did not have a more intimate relationship with him until 2 years later, when I actually got a call from him. And that changed my whole life.
Ardeen Watts is with us, former associate conductor of the Utah Symphony, professor at emeritus of music at the University of Utah. I'll mention that over at Video West, we're featuring a short film we did. We went mushroom hunting with Ardeen. Mushrooms, of course, are the perfect symbol for his life philosophy, or one of them anyway. The piece is called Unruly Things. You can watch it at videowest.org. We're going to take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with Ardeen Watts. Some of you know him. A good number of you would recognize him if you saw him, that energetic elderly gentleman with the shocking white Amish beard. One of the most interesting people you'll ever encounter around here, a musician, a generalist, a heretic. He's joining us here to talk. And where did the beard come from?
Where did the beard come
from? Yeah.
Well, it's a very practical issue.
You've always been that way since I've known you.
Look, when I retired from the U, which was 22 years ago, and I had time to do anything I pleased, the first summer I signed up to go up on the top of the Goshute Mountains with Hawkwatch and catch and band raptors that were heading for Mexico or Point South. And I knew nothing about the birds at that time, but I wanted to know about the birds and especially about the raptors. And I met their leader, their local leader, Steve Hoffman, who was just a brilliant man. I couldn't resist him, so I was on the trail to go up there for 10 days, no water except that was brought in by helicopter. And, I mean, we were just way out.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't shave. When I came home, I had at least a third of an inch of bristle that I had never seen before. And I didn't think anything of it. But I thought, well, I'll leave it a couple of weeks and see what happens. There was a symphony reception. I went to this reception, And by that time, I may have had an inch. And a lady came up to me and said, "Mr. Watts, may I touch your beard?" And that was it. That's the end of the story. I mean, nobody in all of those years had ever, no woman had ever approached me and said, "May I stroke your bare cheek?"
You were in.
So I figured anything, that people were really friendly to beards, and I have kept it ever since. I don't like it. I don't mind the looks of it, but it, you know, it itches. Yeah, yeah. And
it looks great.
And I've never cut it. It just cuts
itself.
Wait,
since then you've never cut it?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've cut the sides down a little bit, but the beard has found its length and it...
It's there.
And it goes and does that. But people have been so friendly. They will approach me when they will not approach a clean-shaven person next door. And that's the end of that.
All right. That's a weird segue into what I want to talk about, which is faith. Let me ask you this. Do you at all feel uncomfortable answering particular questions about your faith journey? Because I want to ask.
Not in the least. I love it.
You do?
Yes. I love it when people ask me. I yearn for it from my own family. And they won't talk about it because they're scared to death.
Yeah. Because they're Orthodox believing Mormons, you're not.
With one exception.
Yeah. So so is there a rule at Thanksgiving, just let's leave faith put aside? Or
no, I do it their way.
Yeah, you do it.
I'm the Thanksgiving prayer.
Is that right?
Yes.
And I bet you'd give a great Thanksgiving
prayer. I'm thoughtful about it, but it's not exactly Orthodox.
No.
But I can be – I know the Orthodox stuff because – I lived that life for 46 years.
But wait, when you're giving the Thanksgiving prayer, do you call upon the God that they would understand?
So that they're comfortable.
Yeah.
And I don't mind because I know that I'm not going to be punished for that.
Okay, so one of the things – so I've read in this interview where you said at the time you didn't think it was an adequate way of describing your place in Mormonism, your situation. At the time, you didn't mind the term Jack Mormon, which we hear from time to time. You just didn't think it was exactly right what you were. You've said heretic might be the right way of describing it. Where are you settled these days? Because you change so much in the way you're thinking about these things. Where are you these days?
Every day changes.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, my so-called epiphany at age 46.
We're going to come back to that, so don't say too much about that yet.
Okay. So
it changes.
It changes. I guess
somebody said, "Ardeen, are you a Mormon?" What do you say?
I say partly. I was 46 years a Mormon. You cannot leave it forever.
Right.
I mean, it's in your blood and in your brain, and I never did leave the Mormon lifestyle.
What does that mean?
That means that I
you don't drink.
Didn't pick up coffee and tea and all that stuff, only because my habit I guess we're so
settled
ingrained. And again, I don't fear punishment or retribution of any kind for it. But and it's far from a sin. It's a total delight to so many people. How can you pass that up? So
I loved how you said, Ardeen, once. There doesn't have to be a qualification for it. You're a Mormon if you say you are. And I say I am. And that's close.
Sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. Okay.
And other times I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
I'm a pantheist.
Yeah.
None of the descriptions fit me exactly, but I'm pretty fluid about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And religion, all religions still intrigue me. I still read and study about them, although I've never been serious about
anyone
joining an institutional religion. And the stories of how people consider themselves religious who do not affiliate with anything are to me some of the most beautiful stories I've ever heard. And I love hearing – that's part of why I talk to people.
Okay. So I want to take you – so let's go to this time in, when you were 46 years old. How many kids do you have at the time?
Our youngest was just – born.
Okay, so the eighth, so you're fully in at this point.
I'm fully in, absolutely.
Now, this was so intriguing because you've called it the event, and this, and you've even pinpointed when this epiphany came to you.
It was about 3:20 in the afternoon on a bus, symphony bus, going to Denver.
Going to Denver. What was it? What can you explain? What happened?
I cannot explain what happened. I explain it differently every time. That's the one thing I have in common with Joseph Smith. I changed my story that often. I know what that's like.
Yeah.
And now I say generally that I was suddenly given permission to find my own way. Mm-hmm. I was given the freedom to create my own religion.
You weren't praying at the time or anything. It just sort of was a thought. That
I didn't.
You were daydreaming?
I was reading a book
that
had nothing to do with faith.
And here's how you've put it. You said everything caved in within a few minutes.
It was like I had the opportunity to assent or resist.
Wow.
And by assenting, which was, I think, choice that I made in that instant, I just felt my whole Mormon belief system melt away. I felt a little like little Black Sambo. It just kind of melted away, and I knew that I was going to be a different person henceforth for the rest of my life, and that this would profoundly affect every one of my children.
Were you sad about that?
Sad?
Yeah.
No, quite the contrary.
Really?
I was.
You didn't think, this is going to be really hard on my family.
I feared it a little bit.
Yeah.
But I was exhilarated by the prospect of freedom. And nowadays, I often frame some of my ideas in Chinese, and the Zhuangzi says in third chapter, in the second chapter, leap into the boundless and make it your home. And that fits in with my improvisatory view of how to live my life. I don't think everybody should espouse a life like that.
Yeah.
It's just the world is full of ways to live. But I love that freedom. And I decided later, for the sake of my family, that I would let them down as gently as possible. And that's why I pray their prayers. And I celebrate with them all of the Mormon
blessings and baptisms.
Events, exactly. And I do it honestly.
Yeah.
It's just that my religion became more inclusive rather than what it had been.
I read this part of this story that you immediately went to read this book. And I was thinking, he's going to go read this anti-Mormon tract or something that's revealed the truth about Mormonism and all that. But that wasn't what the book you were interested in necessarily.
It was a book that had been introduced to me when I was a missionary in the New England states. It was many years, 25 years before. But it had stuck in my head that as I gazed through the contents of that book, there was a reference, or the index, there was a reference to Joseph Smith. And that really caught my eye, and it just burned a hole. And it said something like, Joseph Smith was in the 19th century, a prophet of the God such and such. and it was a name that I didn't recognize. And I was so frightened, given my mission, that I handed it back to the man that gave it to me and said, I can't read this book. And I'm sorry. I'd really like to take your challenge. But it stuck in my head as a forbidden fruit.
Wow.
And
so you have this epiphany and you dash to the Denver Library.
And they had a copy of it. And I spent all day scanning. It's about 1,000 pages. Wow. It's called OASP, OAHSPE. And it was dictated by angels on a primitive typewriter.
Wow.
In the 1850s.
That's amazing.
And there were many aspects of it that were very close to the Joseph Smith story. And as I ran through that, I thought, oh, my gosh. Joseph Smith was not alone. There were all kinds of people who were creating these wonderful, sometimes really wonderful visions. And I became very interested. I almost lived at Sam Weller's bookstore after discovering that, and I started making a list of all of the books that claimed to be of divine origin in the 19th century. And the list went on and on and on and on. So it played a very interesting and a very big role. And when I got through it, I had finally come to terms with what people who claimed to have received some special communication. That took an interesting form much later in my professional life when I was teaching composition. And people would bring their compositions and they really didn't want to hear my opinion, but they had to get my opinion. Because many of them claimed that this was dictated to them by heavenly messengers in dreams.
Inspired.
You'd be surprised how many, mostly amateurs, musicians would bring it with a claim. I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole because I knew how important they were. I mean, they were fundamental to the very lives of these people.
But so you didn't feel deceived, you felt like, this is so interesting that so many people have had these ecstatic experiences.
Oh, you're right. I didn't. Deception was not my relationship as it developed in Mormonism.
Yeah.
I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, and in doing so, depart from a lot of people who have had experiences that led them out of the LDS Church.
Who see him as a fraud or something.
Right. And I don't see that at all. I think that he was he's doing what came natural to him, seeing visions and writing them down.
But did you feel like then after that okay, this thing had sort of caved in, your mind became opened? Did you feel like you had to find some place or start from scratch?
I mean, exactly.
Huh.
And it was the most fun adventure of my life, and it goes on every day. That is, this is many years later. I'm shooting for 92 because for poetic reasons, I would have been an active Mormon for 46 years and a free-floating person for 46 years. And I'm celebrating the second 46 because it is so fun to make life decisions decisions that matter, that really matter, based on how do you live a life? And I'm it's an additive principle that is. There are limitless ways to live a life, at least 8 billion.
Okay, at last count. So So you don't necessarily see yourself just as a Christian, for example, or do you? And I'm wondering, do you believe that there are supernatural there's a supernatural realm, that those kinds of things happen?
There is a supernatural realm, but we have no way of knowing it, and it's different. Everybody who has a glimpse of it glimpses it apparently differently, and so it isn't one of those things that can fit into a scientific world where there is one way. And who am I to be the judge of all of those people who are devoted? All of the hundreds in my own family who are really devoted, sincere people, and who do not want to give up anything that they have, and nor should. And now I believe that they shouldn't.
Yeah.
That is, I've lost all semblance of being a missionary. You mentioned Jesus a minute ago.
Yeah.
And no, I am not a Christian, because I do not believe that the human being has need of redemption. That is, we come with a clean slate and we leave with a clean slate. And most people and if they do their best or their worst, it's not in my business.
What do you think about this idea of, just along that line, vicarious sacrifice? You know, a lot of Christians
believe
that.
I'm not in it. You know, things like that seem to work. My wife was in a terrible accident about 12 years ago. That is, a truck hit her as a pedestrian, and they had to take out a sizable amount of her right frontal lobe. So that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And when she was told that people in Japan were praying for her, because our daughter lived in Japan and belonged to an LDS ward there, it made a difference to her. So what happens in that world happens, and may happen to me. I struggle to give an explanation, and I say, well, that was a synchronicity. Meeting my friend who introduced me to classical music, meeting Maurice Abravanel and many other watermark moments. And they do occur, and miracles do happen that we cannot explain. And the more the better, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not going to judge between them. They've happened to me, and I can't explain them at all. And the very fact that I moved, that I leaped into the boundless, was a miracle. I can't explain, nor do I want to explain it. I think that we're obsessed in this scientific era with origins and causes. What comes before this? What comes before that? And there are some questions that are just too good to ask or answer either way. And so I'm very happy. That the boundless is a very happy place.
You're 87. You want to make it to 92. So do you think about death?
I smile when I think of it. I make jokes about it. I live across the street from a cemetery.
Yes.
And I really look forward to that adventure. I'm not anxious for this one to end, because it's every day a big deal to me to acknowledge that I have the gift of another day. And I have no desire whatsoever to end it, but it will end, and I go not screaming, not kicking into the night. I go, I hope, smiling.
Gently
into the night, yes.
Ardeen Watts, former associate conductor of the Utah Symphony, professor emeritus of music at the University of Utah. I mentioned the video short we have at Video West, where we go mushrooming with our Dean Watts. We'll talk about that when we get back from a break. The piece is called Unruly Things. You can watch it at videowest.org. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, our Dean Watts is with us here in the studio. We're talking about a lot of things, aren't we?
I hope so.
I want to ask about mushrooms. Now, one thing I read was that your father, who was an Orthodox Mormon, but he worked really hard during the week, and he did reserve Sunday to go hunting and fishing.
I wouldn't say Sunday.
He
went once a week, all day. Huh. But not necessarily Sunday, no.
Yeah.
He was a better Mormon than that.
Did you consider that? So he was sort of hunting and gathering, right? I guess the question is, you saw your father foraging, you saw him hunting, you saw him gathering. Did that have an influence on the hunter-gatherer? The gatherer that you would be.
It had a negative influence.
Wow.
That is, when I became my own head of the house, and I had decisions to make about how I would live my life, I began to reflect about having taken such delight in the death struggles of the fish that I had caught and the critters that I had delighted in hitting in the head with a bullet. And I thought that that was really a bad thing for me within the scope of my thinking at the time.
Yeah.
And I had to do penance. That penance consisted of 15 years of vegetarian, which just about drove the rest of my family crazy. Not to mention people who hosted events at which I was a guest. And so I finally gave it up after 15 years just because it was such a nuisance to everybody else. And I guess I had kind of paid my debt. And the mushrooms were a direct response to that. Hmm. That is a way that I could relate to the wild, which I craved and adored in every respect, and without endangering stuff. I was very careful where I stepped so that I didn't kill plants that were struggling to live, and mushrooms seemed to be fair game. I doubted that they had feelings, although since I have learned that they're closer to animals than they are plants. And that was a little bit of a shock that I had to get used to. But
what you like about them, at least, is so many things. But that there's sort of this unruly thing that takes hold.
Unruly is right. And it's not so much unruly as it is unpredictable.
Yeah.
Their appearance is still in many circles thought of as signs from heaven. That is, when a fairy ring occurs that is 20 feet across, it is a fairy ring to many people. And as I've learned the science of mushrooms, that is no longer what links me to it isn't that mystery. It's other mysteries. And the other mystery is that the fungi just happen to be an absolute essential part of the ecology of the planet. And that's what followed eventually my interest in eating them and harvesting and foraging for them. I've eaten maybe 100 varieties of wild mushroom. I've probably had 20 varieties growing on the house that we raised our children in, the yard where we raised our children. And I have introduced hundreds of people to the fine art of harvesting and foraging for wild mushrooms. They remain a great mystery to me, and I love the mysterious part. I love unanswered questions.
You once told me that there are probably only two steps, maybe three, from anything to ultimate things.
Isn't that the way you think? My guess it is. Everything that has life, it's only one step to confrontation with the question of how and why did it all come about?
Yeah.
And if this isn't mystery, what is? I mean, the Starry Night is still, with all we know about it, we know less about it than we thought we knew 100 years ago. And that is, we're facing a universe of dark matter and dark energy that we have no notion what it is. And I really care and am intrigued by those things. And I find that anything that we do, all of the relationships that we have with the animate and the inanimate, quickly come to ultimate things. And the ultimate things are, for the most part, unanswerable in my mind, nor do they have to have answers. I celebrate that they don't have answers. I celebrate the mystery.
Yeah. When we were talking earlier about that moment, that epiphany you had when things seemed to cave in, and you had to rebuild. One of the things you did, we talked about that you had gone out and gotten this book to read. But another thing you said you did, and I was intrigued by, is you bought a pair of roller skates.
I don't know that the roller skates were directly
attached. They weren't part of the epiphany?
No. They're part of my I'm drawn irresistibly to things that are kind of quirky and are that might be real expressions of myself.
Yeah.
And the idea of the roller skates actually occurred to me in Denver on a symphony tour when I was frustrated by having a day off and had to rely on no transportation. And I thought roller skates would be a good way because as a kid, I was really good at hopping the roots of the trees and the broken sidewalks. And so I bought a pair of roller skates mail order, and they were delivered the night that we were leaving for – the symphony was leaving for a tour of Northern California. And so I woke up in the morning in San Francisco with a new pair of roller skates in my baggage, and I put them on, and I got into big trouble early, had a major crash that involved almost every exposed part of my face, and not to be deterred, the next morning I headed for the Golden Gate Bridge. And I was ordered off the bridge. I challenged the man. I went into the guardhouse for the bridge, and I said, I want to see the book where it says that you cannot roller skate on the Golden Gate Bridge. And I might have been the first person ever to do that. I went all the way across and back.
We've got about a minute left or so. So this is not enough time to talk about you conducting Leonard Bernstein's Mass. But I do want you to say something about that piece of music because that was meaningful to you.
Well, it was just for pure proportions, a huge enterprise, two rock bands, full symphony orchestra, the combined choirs of the university, and 20 soloists that I had gathered from the local group. But what really intrigued me about the Mass was that the United States celebrated the opening of a national theater, the Kennedy Center, by commissioning a Jew to write a Mass.
Yeah.
And to me, that was just perfection itself. And when I heard Mass, I mean, what I heard was the struggle of institutional religions to change with the times so that they remained meaningful. To me, that was the symbolism of Mass. It was a bold piece. It was an irreverent piece. It would never pass muster as a real celebration of the Catholic Mass. But in spirit, it was the ultimate redemptive piece that I had ever – no, it wasn't the most ultimate redemptive piece. I would say that goes to Mahler. Huh. But for Bernstein to write that piece, and it was really written for the youth. It's the West Side – if West Side Story is the youthful tale – of Romeo and Juliet for our time, then Mass is the transformation of institutional religion into a language that young people can understand.
Ardeen Watts, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Go to Video West and you can see Unruly Things, a short video there, videowest.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.